This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Nicholas Bamba, Head of Private Credit at LGIM Real Assets, and Mark Benstead, Head of Pan-European Credit. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning, all.
Well, today we're going to cover some of the themes rippling across the investment landscape in recent weeks, as well as diving into public and private credit markets. So, with no further ado, Sonia, of the many noteworthy market and macro developments since our last call, which is at the forefront of your thinking, and why does this matter to investors?
Yes, thanks, Max. And I think it's fair to say that, as we said last time, it's all about inflation and central banks this year. It's even more so the case this time round, because what we have seen since our last webinar is that we have experienced a real acceleration in the way the market is now coming to terms with the level of financial tightening that central banks will apply this year. As you recall, when we talked last time, it's been really a step change since the beginning of the year. As you recall, we finished the year 2021 on all-time highs across equity markets and with a 10-year treasury at 1.5. And we knew it couldn't last. We knew it was wrong. And obviously, ever since, we have seen an adjustment in market, understanding that clearly, economically, we are still looking good, but inflation obviously is stubbornly high, and the prints we've been seeing, particularly in the US and here in the UK, clearly have meant that central banks need to change their communication. They need to move more towards the hawkish view that they need to do something. We have seen obviously the hikes from the Bank of England. We are now expecting the Fed to start in March, but it's more the number of hikes the market is now pricing in that has seen quite a step change. And we are now looking for 5 hikes this year for the Fed and the Bank of England. And if you recall, towards the end of last year, it was probably about 2-3 in the second half. So this is a step change from where we were. And not surprisingly, you obviously have seen bond yields move dramatically on the back of this. Probably most notable, the recent moves in bunds. Obviously, Germany always had the whole curve in negative territory. And there we have now seen a market shift into positive territory. It's not just interest rates. It is the reduction of balance sheets as well. So we're having a combined impact in terms of monetary tightening. And this is why it's been predominantly real yields that have been moving nominal yields. And as such, obviously, this is clearly something we're watching very carefully. But it's fair to say that the very fast move that we have been seeing in markets probably now is closer to reflecting the expectations with regards to monetary tightening. So if we now add equities to the equation, it's very clear that we have seen the rate sensitive areas, in particular technology, taking the biggest hit. Although it's fair to say that ever since we are seeing a more nuanced picture, yes, equity markets are still down, but clearly have been able to recover from the worst of the impact early January. And I think investors now really need to take a stance and have a look at their portfolio. Economic growth is still healthy. And although obviously Omicron have had a bit of an impact on Q4 numbers, we are still expecting above trend growth for developed markets in 2022. And as such, the expectation that equities should be the better asset class. Although we are looking for leadership changes within equities, and we can probably come to this a bit later. But it's clearly obviously all eyes on fixed income. And we very strongly believe it is what's happening in global bond markets that will dictate what is happening across global asset markets this year. It is the inflection point that we're looking for. Although what is worth mentioning is that although expectations for rate hikes have seen a significant upward movement, the final, you know, the long end, so the understanding of where the rate cycle might peak hasn't moved much. So there's still this question mark. Once we are really fully normalized, once we are beyond the immediate kind of inflation peak and eventually we'll see the transitory elements subside, are we potentially regrowth low inflation environment that was so obvious prior to the pandemic? This is the balancing act for central banks, because obviously it's very clear if they're acting too prematurely and too aggressively, they will risk a recession. Obviously, if they wait too long and inflation expectations become unanchored, they will have to do a lot more to bring that back under control. So that is the same dilemma that will continue until we have greater clarity coming from the data. And this probably is not to be expected until probably end of Q2, early Q3 this year.
Right. So there's been a step change in the central bank narrative, driven largely by inflation dynamics and a huge amount for investors to consider, in particular fixed income, with questions about the end game and terminal rates, which means it's a great point at which to bring Mark into the conversation. Mark, as Sonia mentioned, we've recently seen a hawkish shift across a number of central banks, including, of course, the Bank of England very recently, both in terms of rates and QE, especially regarding its portfolio of corporate bonds. Is the market correctly pricing in this new posture, and how might it play out for UK credit?
I wish I knew a definitive answer to that, Max, but I'll give it a go, right? So, I mean, a week has always been a long time in politics, right? Just ask Boris that. But it's also been, it was literally last week, last Thursday, that we had the Bank of England and the ECB meetings, which Sonia alluded to, which actually both, I mean, they genuinely really did shock the market, both in different ways, but they were definitely shocks to the market. Nobody really saw four members of the MPC voting for a 50 basis point hike, which they did, even though there were a couple of forecasts that you might get one or two vote for 50 basis points. So that was the first shock. The greater surprise with the Bank of England was, as you said, Max, that the announcement that they're going to sell down their 20 billion of corporate bonds that they bought as part of the QE program. So just to put some numbers on it, 20 billion is around 5% of the corporate bond market. And 20 billion is actually small beer compared to the ECB's holding of corporate bonds, which is around 350 billion and about 15% of the corporate bond market. But the ECB, since they started buying them, have been buying around about a third of every single new issues. How are they going to do it? We're not quite sure. They're not going to announce the mechanics of that. There is some precedent in that they did unwind a 1.6 billion corporate bond holding they had back in 2012, I think it was, just by announcing which bonds they were making available to the market and you could put bids in, et cetera. But this is of a different quantum. So they've said that they're not going to do it before towards the end of 2023. So were that to be held to, it's around about 900 million sterling equivalent per month. So let's call it 200 to 250 million a week. It's a year's worth of supply. So it's a decent number, right? And it's definitely going to be an overhang to the market going forward. What did the market do on the announcement? Well, not only did gilt yields sell off, as Sonia alluded to, but actually corporate bond spreads widened. We widened around 20% in 3 days. Now, as an active corporate bond manager, you know, we embrace volatility, but the moves were so sharp and the bid offer spreads kind of widened, it was actually pretty difficult to crystallize the opportunities that threw themselves up, which was frustrating because we were well positioned for the widening to have taken place. And we haven't really managed to bank as much of that as we, in hindsight, would have liked, because actually we've seen around about a 50% retracement in that corporate bond spread widening since last Thursday. And actually, coincidentally, the euro market behaved pretty similarly. We had about a 15 to 20% widening in euros, and it has also retraced about half of that going forward. But in some ways, I think the ECB and Lagarde's announcements were more surprising, perhaps, than the Bank of England in the kind of the tapering timeline. And the market is now pricing in two rate hikes from the ECB by the end of this year. And bear in mind, they haven't hiked rates since 2008, which was a shocking mistake at the time, which was swiftly reversed when we had the GFC, et cetera. So, you know, you've got rates in Europe back to zero by the first quarter of next year. So that's a real change and a kind of, as Sonia alluded to, a recognition of the inflationary backdrop that lies ahead. And to make it very timely, we have US CPI this afternoon, which will give us some more clues as well. So, sorry, that was a long answer to a short question, but it's been lively.
that's a really useful context, I think, both in the UK and Europe about what this shift means for the market. Longer term, how are you looking to navigate this dramatic move?
As Sonia said, we've got 5 rate hikes priced in into the UK and into the US. Now, as recently as September last year, there were only like 2 voting members of the Fed forecasting any rate hikes in 23. Okay, so I think an awful lot is in the market. I mean, if you look at the UK, right, we're about, you know, your energy bills are about to go up 50%. Your tax is going up by 1.5%. This is a bit of a personal opinion, but I don't think you will really feel that as a consumer until you actually see it when those bills come through. And what that will do to kind of discretionary spending in light of reopening, I don't know. But I think there's an awful lot priced into the market. Certainly our rates guys think that the market is probably overdoing the amount of tightening that we're going to see in the UK over the next 12 months. And you know, the 50 basis point was a real kind of shock, and maybe a very clever shock vote to that. So, you know, we are ready. We are absolutely ready to act. And we are very happy to front load our response. And then going back to Sonia's point, we might see this time next year, we might be in a very much more normal, whatever that is anymore, normal world in terms of low inflation, low growth. The Bank of England's forecast for growth in 22 in the UK is 1.25% versus 4.5% this year, and 1% in 24. So, you know, that is not a buoyant backdrop necessarily. We could be cutting. And actually, if you look at the market, look to the middle of next year, and we're actually forecasting rate cuts in the UK.
Nick, turning to your asset class, what does the rising rate environment mean for private credit investors?
Yeah, I think rising rates is more a question of what it's going to do to spreads. I mean, I think most of our investors are really spread-based investors. They, you know, they care about their differential. And clearly, we've seen, as Mark's been talking about, some of that move this year already. You know, it's moving up and down, but it's definitely widened out. And the key thing you see in the private markets is it always takes the private markets to sort of more time to sort of go up and more time to come down. So quick volatility honestly doesn't make much difference. But the expectation that that spread probably will drift, certainly for the first half of this year, that's our expectation. I think even though some of it's retraced, I think that's starting to happen across the piece. You know, that is clearly, investors will see that as an opportunity. The question is, how quickly will that translate into private market spreads? And that is far more driven by the sort of the simple supply, demand and supply that is out there for assets, which are essentially coming out of the private banking market, being bought by institutional investors. And there is still a lot of money chasing that that space. So the demand supply issues, when you're relating to credit spreads, is the key factor. And so some people are definitely, some of the, you know, talked to 2 different clients this week, you know, very much seeing that as a bit of an opportunity, and they're not overselling it, because I think Mark's comments that actually it could be a return to normal second half of this year and, you know, maybe next year. But there is definitely an opportunity to see things drift a little wider, and they can take that opportunity. The question's going to be, will it actually translate into real new issue pricing around that demand and supply?
Right. And on that point, where do you see the biggest opportunities and risks with regard to sectors and areas such as infrastructure and alternative debts?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. So I think the infrastructure remains incredibly hot, whether there is far more demand than there is supply. It's the sector everybody wants. It wants to be involved in it, all sorts of renewable reasons. Everyone's sort of chasing that space. So there's no subtlety that there's not enough opportunity to satisfy the demand. So in pure financial terms, you know, that's probably not a huge opportunity from a pure returns perspective. But clearly, people are seeing the value of social impact, and we talk about that a bit more later. So I think infrastructure is its own space. I think interesting real estate debt's an interesting space at the moment, because actually the real estate markets, the valuations have stood up better than people expected a year or so ago. In fact, some of them have come back with unbelievable valuation positions. And those that held their, and quite a few people who were concerned on the equity side about coming to the market, they're now bringing their opportunities to the market because they've got more stable valuations, they can raise finance. And I think we are seeing some opportunities there which are showing proper valuation. So I think real estate debt is an interesting space because of the underlying nature of the market. Albeit, and this is tied into alternatives, there are some transition assets. So some assets which are transitioning, you know, we all know secondary offices, nobody wants them anymore. What are you going to do with those kind of assets? How are they going to transition? How are they going to be structured from a financing perspective? And there are some potentially some opportunities there which are drifting more towards alternatives than they are towards the real estate. And then I think there's some clear opportunities in what I would call the financial space at the short end. Again, banks are seeking to either loosen their balance sheets or offload some of the things where they've just had to explode the amount of lines they've got around either commodities or around financial assets, and those are looking to come out into the institutional market. So I think there's also some good opportunities at the short end.
Well, thank you for that perspective, Nick. Sonia, you alluded earlier towards a potential shift in market leadership in equities. What have we learned so far in the flurry of fourth quarter earnings?
Yes, Max, before I go to the earnings result, I think what we have learned so far from listening to Mark and Nick, it's very clear that for most investors this year is the dilemma how to meet the return objectives they have. We know that the starting point was such that valuations were unattractive pretty much across the board. So you're facing the dilemma of higher volatility because we're facing an inflection point, but at the same time with a much more moderate return profile across pretty much all asset classes. Hence, you have to be far more careful how you choose the opportunities you want to invest for. We hear a lot of clients that particular with their broad fixed income exposure, they need to understand, you know, not everyone can be as tactical and really capture opportunities that might arise from dislocations or the market pricing in specific scenarios too quickly. So I think this will be probably one of the driving forces that we will see behind asset allocation decisions. And because of the economic backdrop, equities will have to remain one source of revenue return generation. And within equity markets, it's very clear that obviously, as we heard already from Nick, financials now finally seem to have at least, you know, a day in the sun. Maybe it is 2 days or three. But it's very clear that the rising interest rate environment, rising bond yields, actually, it is a positive for financials. We have seen, obviously, some of that rotation already. And we expect that there will be more to come. The other areas clearly, and that again has played out already, have been the commodities spectrum. Obviously the high oil price, if you look at the top performers, it's not surprising to see the big oil majors there at the top of the list. Now, when it comes to the earnings results and how you will look at those to judge how 2022 might pan out, supply disruptions still will feature. You will see some companies focusing on the impact those supply chain disruptions have had on their business, and it will come down to how well they are equipped now to deal with those going forward. Commodity prices still play a role, and I think there will be a real focus now with the forward-looking statements. What is the impact on inflation on the business model, right? What is the pricing power for a company to raise prices to the consumer? What are the lag effects and how quickly they can do this? And that again will obviously determine how they can balance the higher input costs with potentially obviously raising prices to the end consumer. Again, there will be huge differences across sectors and companies, and hence, although you know equities will probably do well on average, there will be big shifts within. And I think there was obviously a lot of focus already on technology, and we have seen very mixed results, with the obvious outlier obviously being Meta, so Facebook, with the first, not warning, but the first hint ever that their tremendous kind of user growth is definitely plateauing. And that obviously has sent the stock down 25% on one day. On the flip side, you have seen Microsoft obviously coming in with very robust results, same for Amazon. So it is not one fits all, but clearly there have been a lot of focus already on technology in particular, because it has been the main driver of equity market returns for so long. that you find out that there might be some funds being ill-prepared for that massive shift. And obviously, you see in the magnitude of moves that, you know, it's really good to understand what are the driving forces of earnings growth across this year.
Mark, the current energy shock that you also talked about earlier in terms of bills that consumers will start paying, are already paying, is clearly related to the broader ESG challenge of climate change alongside a large number of other factors, perhaps including geopolitics. How are you tackling this theme?
Well, from a portfolio positioning standpoint, Max, which I think is what you're really asking me, right? So we have been deliberately underweight gas distribution names for some time, and we're not the only people to have kind of gone down that track, right? It's been an easy sector to avoid and be careful of, but it can be overstated, right? I mean, Philip, this is very anecdotal, but a friend of mine renovating a house thought, I'll do the right thing. I'll have a look at a ground source heat pump, 60,000. Okay, so it's about a 25-year payoff. And he could afford to do that, but he's not. Anyway, so that's kind of by the by. So I think rumors of the death of gas are much exaggerated, but it's a very easy to be kind of underweight. And actually, they haven't moved as much as they might. So that's a long-held position which will continue to run. I think the other one is going back to Sonia's point about how is this affecting input costs of corporates? How able are they to pass it on? And there's two sides of that. There's the industrial side, where we did have industrial shutdowns in the fourth quarter of last year, just on gas supply disruption and pricing. And then clearly you've got the kind of consumer side, where it is a real hit to real disposable income. So, you know, we want to be very careful, I think, about getting too carried away, too balled up on the impact of reopening. So there's kind of leisure, discretionary consumer spending, when there's going to be such a real hit to those at the lower income end, which actually have the highest marginal propensity to spend in the first place. So I think it's potentially a big overhang. And going back to my previous point, I don't think you'll feel it until you see it. And I really feel very strongly about that. I don't really know, rightly or wrongly, what a 54% increase in my energy bill is going to look like or feel like. I'm equally convinced that the government's kind of response, there's £200 off your council tax, but we'll have it back in four installments over 2 years, unless you're in the four lowest bands, is a particularly strong offsetter. So we are underweight, physical gas names, and we are concerned about the impact on consumer spending and those sectors as well. And just going back to Sonia's point on returns, and you've got to make really interesting point on returns. So vanilla corporate fixed income this year in sterling, -5% total return after 6 weeks. Like, wow. Okay. And that's coming on back of a negative year last year. Now, here's one to tuck away for everyone. The last year in which global fixed income produced two consecutive negative total return, okay, 1983. Okay, so it's been a very long time since we had two negative total return years, but yeah, it seems like a big reach from here for it to kind of display positive. The flip side of that argument is you could say, well, maybe we're entering 40 years of mean reversion the other way, but that's maybe a topic for another day, Max.
As a bond investor, that's a really exciting thought.
The glass is always half empty, Nick. You know that.
Yeah, yeah, quite right too. Quite right. Stand up for debt. Yeah.
That's a striking piece of information. Thank you, Mark. Nick, thinking about energy and clearly the related theme of responsible investing, how can private credit investors play a role in achieving positive ESG outcomes?
Look, the most positive thing that private investors can do is get involved in the construction of new energy sources. That's the thing that I think differentiates what the private can do versus the public. Public gets it later down the line when, you know, it's a big portfolio or part of a corporate entity. And so clearly the, you know, the building of wind farms, the building of solar, you know, those are the kind of things that really can happen. And it is happening. And so that's good. There was definitely a bit of a hiatus around end of 2021 as people were working out how this is going to shape through. So that's not surprising. We're starting to see that flow through. And it's not just happening, you know, in the sort of traditional areas. We're definitely going to new places. You know, Spain has been active in terms of some of the renewable pieces. Poland, so, you know, we're going to some new parts of, or is it institutional investors are going to new parts, I think would be the way I'd put that. So I think that's where you can really make a profound difference. I think we're all seeing other sort of what I call smaller micro innovations, which is where we are rewarding some entities for transitioning from low quality housing stock to high quality housing stock. So we're seeing that actually in the public and the private market. Sort of the green bond initiative is a public and private piece where there is financial incentive to do that. And I think that is making a difference, and I think that is a positive. And I think that's part of what we need to do as a community, which is to say, you know, we do value that transition, and we're going to reward that behaviour. So I think it's construction, and I think it's then prodding the behaviour with a little bit of cash to support it.
Thanks, Nick. So profound differences and micro innovations, my two takeaways there. Sonia, we've, as always, covered a huge amount of ground today. You've already touched on some of the areas about return expectations and this remarkable moment that investors are in right now. What are the other key takeaways for investors? And is there anything you'd like to add?
Clearly, the return expectations have to be a key driver of any consideration if you try to invest in markets this time. And I think the other point that was very obvious today is that of liquidity, as Nick highlighted. Even if you now look at obviously public bond markets and you're looking for an alternative because you just feel that you can't stomach the volatility that potentially is ahead, or even two consecutive years of negative returns, it is not just, you know, switching from public to potentially private or any other pocket, because there's an enormous liquidity mismatch. And Nick will know very clearly how difficult it is to deploy the demand that we are seeing from clients. And I think this is to some extent the dilemma that we're facing in terms of finding good opportunities in a context of a, you know, profound shift away from, you know, Mark has highlighted, it's been since the 80s. And we should not forget, global fixed income has delivered such a phenomenal combination of positive returns, hedging and diversification benefits, obviously at scale. It was available for everyone. And I think we need to just make sure that we are staying humble, because understanding what the implication is of this central bank shift in particular, and as Mark has so neatly highlighted, just thinking about the volume and the potential impact on you know, the functioning of public markets, it can be quite daunting, and we have to prepare for dislocations, because we have lived with a steady and continuous central bank support for so long. Trying to remove this at pace, at scale, will not be an easy undertaking. And I guess we all expect central banks to be very mindful of this, because they know how long it took on the way in. So if you try and squeeze this into a 12-month exit window, it does not seem particularly right. But I think that really is obviously the backdrop we're operating in. I think Nick has highlighted as well what obviously investors are looking for in terms of the structural themes, right? What are the drivers that clearly will not only get public support, but private support? Because we know that, for example, energy transition is clearly a multi-year, multi-decade project and will require a lot of capital. But I think there we then come to obviously the need for the right policy framework as well for us to get the certainty to put private capital to work. So it is a lot to digest, and the understanding of how to navigate this in the context of the unwinding pandemic is clearly what we're here to do. And it will be a step-by-step approach. We don't have any historic precedents that would give us any guidance on how the next 12, 24, 36 months will look like. And as such, we can only navigate in on a step-by-step approach and understanding the tails, because those clearly have grown in importance and are a lot bigger than what they were a couple of months ago. And as such, we will hopefully be able to provide more insights in how we aim to navigate the backdrop, and look forward to more data points that hopefully support that vision.
Thanks, Sonia. Yes, of course. And we will check in with our listeners over the course of this year as this story unfolds. Well, look, finally, I would just like to ask everyone what you've been watching, reading, or listening to in recent weeks. I will get the ball rolling and say I've been watching the original version of House of Cards, an old BBC production with Ian Richardson, which is fascinating, quite Shakespearean, and resonates in the current political moment. Sonia, what have you been consuming?
More sports oriented. I'm watching the Olympics. I'm a huge fan of these sports events. And actually, I have to say that the Winter Olympics now, for the first time, I think, get real coverage here in the UK, which is amazing. And I love to watch all these events.
That's great. And Nick?
I think I'm going to probably commit a bit of cultural suicide here, but I decided, I was coming home last night and I listened to Adele's 30 album, having had to endure my children ranting at the Brits the previous night. And I go, okay, I'm going to listen to it. I really enjoyed 21, 25, and I thought it was awful. I thought it was the most miserable album I've listened to in forever. And playing out your emotions in public is something that, as a Brit, I obviously, or as an older Brit, I didn't appreciate. Anyway, so I loved the previous thing, but that was one thing I didn't like. And, I don't know what you all thought about that.
It's great you've got a strong view. I'm not sure if Adele is a listener to Elgin Talks, but if she
No, I know. Well, you know, maybe she is or isn't.
Thank you, Nick. And Mark?
This might get me in trouble as well. I'm going to start, can I finish where I started? I'm reading the Tom Bowers biography of Boris, aptly called The Chancellor, right? So it's very aptly called The Chancellor, and I'll leave it there before I genuinely get myself in trouble. And what I'm watching, this is interesting actually, because my daughter told me to watch this. I've just watched Tinder Swindler on Netflix, which is literally unbelievable. I mean, and very disturbing and sad. I'm glad I watched it, but I'm even more glad that she watched it.
Right. Very good to know. We've got a good list of potential recommendations for our listeners as well. Look, thank you all very much for your time today, Sonia, Mark and Nick. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO call will be in March, when Sonia will be joined by Howie Lee and Matt Rees. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels on the Elgin blog and, of course, here on Elgin Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording, and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgin.com. Copyright 2021, Legal and General Investment Management Limited. all rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, a licensed corporation, BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.